Banya 82, one day at a time. It is July 2nd as we go through this tournament in our timeline. It is an amazing day in the second round. On paper, at the very least, you got West Germany against Spain. That coming up a little bit later. Brazil and Argentina. Brazil take their bow in the second phase. Argentina are clinging on by their fingernails, Mick Foley.
Yeah, they are a little bit, aren't they? And they kind of looked, the fingernails even are starting to remove themselves from the fingers after the Italian performance as well. It wasn't good. And like, you know, like every single time we've had Brazil coming into this tournament, coming into a match, it's just like you're kind of just waiting to see what are they going to do this time? What amazing memory are they going to leave us with this time around? But obviously, it being Brazil-Argentina, there's always an edge. You're never quite 100% sure what's happening, but, you know, it's got the feel of, is this the end? Is this the moment where the era ends for Argentina and another one begins?
Kieran, yeah, world champions clinging to their title, needing a win. Probably, you can tell me in detail if there needs to be added to this, but more than just a 1-0 win as well.
Hello, Rob. Yeah, I love when you throw the arithmetical problems at me for first thing.
All yours.
I can always go with the de facto. That would be an ecumenical matter, Ted.
They had to win, and they definitely would have benefited.
They needed to
winning.
Do it impressively, okay?
Comfortably, yes. Billy Joe Patton, we put Maradona and Brazil together for you. No, we haven't. I don't know why I'm saying we have done that. How much power do I think we have here? But anyways, this seems like a perfect rewatch for your very good self.
Yeah, it's up there. It's definitely up there. I think, you know, when you look at the greatest football rivalry there is, when you consider, like, there's probably some really good ones in Europe. When you consider the flair and the quality, the technical ability of players that generally Brazil squads and Argentina squads can put out there, I think it's unmatched. And yeah, I was really looking forward to it. And I was pleasantly surprised in some cases. I kind of thought that it was a better game than I was expecting, but we got a chance to go through that.
Yeah, looking forward to it. And I know all of you are excited about our guest coming on from Italia 90, one day at a time, to España 82, one day at a time. Back with us again, Marcelo Mora y Araujo. You are very, very welcome. And thank you so much for coming on to chat about Argentina just before they slip out of this tournament.
Well, I'm not going to even acknowledge that remark. It's a pleasure.
it's a pleasure to discuss
the early and unhappy demise of Argentina in 1982. Let's hope we don't have to discuss it again.
It's funny, how is this remembered? Because we went into this World Cup thinking this isn't a great tournament for them, lots of chaos around the team. We've had some moments, though, where we've really, really enjoyed the way Argentina played, especially in the victory over Hungary. By and large, though, they came into this game not in great form.
It's an interesting one, 1982, because it's kind of sandwiched between two World Cup victories. So it's the kind of golden period, if you like, of Argentina's international performance. 78 was joy and happiness and unexpected delight amid a really difficult kind of political and social scenario back home. So it was particularly relished as a month of joy and, you know, distraction from real life problems, which is the point of football, I suppose, for many at least. And of course, in 1982, we didn't know we would win again in 1986. Forgive me for saying we, I had no part in these victories, but they won for us as but there was a lot of expectation before the tournament. Obviously, it was a great team. It was the 1978 winners at their prime. I mean, I went on in life to kind of co-author Ozzy Ardiles's autobiography, and he likes to say they were as fit but more mature as they had been in 78. The bunch of lads who'd played already and won. And to that kind of backbone was added Diego Maradona, who Menotti had considered not quite right for 1978. And a couple of young, promising stars that had done incredibly well in the 1979 Youth World Cup, which Menotti himself had taken on after 78 because he wanted to work with a young squad and kind of be involved in forming the next generation. And they were Ramon Diaz and Jorge Valdano. Now, Valdano in the end couldn't play because he got appendicitis or hepatitis or somitis. But Ramon Diaz was fabulous. So this idea that we had the complete kind of brilliant alchemy of experience and youth, but somehow it never quite gelled. And I think the first game against Belgium was okay. In fact, there were moments of brilliance from Maradona. Hungary was good, but then by the time Belgium, the result wasn't good enough. So then Argentina had to play Italy and Brazil, the way the tournament was set up. And Italy was a complete surprise, quite how much Maradona was marked to the point that he could hardly play. I mean, some of those players like to say that FIFA changed the rules after that. It was so grotesque, the marking he had and the injuries he sustained. But by then, Maradona was angry and frustrated and perhaps showing already some of the difficult personality traits he would have. So in Brazil, he just lashed out. And in fact, I mean, I years later translated his autobiography into English. And in it, he says he actually just lashed out against a player. He didn't even know who he was, and he thought it was someone who'd fouled him, but it was the wrong guy. But the whole thing just became quite unseeming and horrendous, really. It wasn't, sometimes you can play beautifully and then the result isn't with you. I mean, but this was just horrible. It was horrible. And I think it kind of, if memory serves, because also then football has this thing whereby we reconstruct the memory over time. So it becomes ingrained, especially socially or collectively. The war against England, which was called a conflict, but it, shared front page space in the Argentinian press with the World Cup. A lot of those players knew people. They're the same generation as kids who would be drafted. We had compulsory military service in this country, so they either had friends or relatives, or they themselves might have just come out of military service. They wouldn't have been sent to the front because they were footballers, but they had to do, office duties and things. So it was very tense, and a lot of them then went on to say, with hindsight, they didn't really know what was going on. They believed the Argentinian press and the propaganda. And then when they got to Spain, they realized what the world press was saying and what the real situation was. So they felt lied to. Some were conflicted about representing a government or a country that they felt at odds with. Others were, professional footballers, we can just do this. We don't need to think about anything else. But it was really an uncomfortable World Cup in every way, on the pitch and off it. And then I think because 1986 happened, it became easier to just kind of neglect 82 as a little blip in the history of the national team's football prowess. So I think if that had been our last performance ever, that might be what we stay with. But since then, another World Cup was picked up, two finals were reached, Messi appeared on the scene. So there isn't really an onus to kind of, as a nation, say, let us discuss what happened in 82. So it's become kind of slightly under-analyzed, I think, is my personal opinion.
We're fixing that, Marcella. Don't you worry. We're fixing that one day at a time here.
I'm fascinated, and I know we've discussed it on previous episodes, by the situation Ozzy Ardiles found himself in 82, because he was based in England when war broke out. And he returned to Argentina, as I understand it, for training camp, and then decides to go to Paris Saint-Germain on loan for a year. So obviously the conflict must have had a huge impact on him above all other players.
Well, it's really interesting because he says now that it did have a huge impact on him, and in fact helped him enter quite a deep depression for a while. But at the time, he hadn't quite sensed it as such. And he went back to join the Argentina squad as planned. The Argentinian invasion of the Falklands or Malvinas, or the reclaiming of its territory, as the military put it, happened to coincide with a schedule that was already in place. So Ozzy went off to Argentina and then carried on believing what he heard in Argentina, and was in touch over the phone with friends in England, particularly Ricky Villa, who wasn't in the Argentina squad and therefore stayed to play the FA Cup. And so Ozzy says he didn't really, it didn't really sink in. For Ricky, it was really weird and tough, because before the final, it was agreed that he wouldn't play because if Tottenham were to win, the awards were going to be given out by the Princess Royal. I think it was quite tense. I mean, I don't know. I'm not privy to all the details, but I think Tottenham wanted him to play, but were also aware that this was really delicate and contentious. And then in the end, Ricky decided not to play. But for him, I mean, he's a great guy, and he says, you know, I just scored one goal in my career, and I don't know if everyone knows what goal that is, but
not going to get a cup final named after them.
Yeah. He was, you know, it really was a big deal for his career. It's not, he wasn't going to play for Argentina, and so that was that. But then Ozzy, I think after the World Cup, where he says, you know, he was really focused. He wanted to do well. He had the energy and the push. That he'd already won a World Cup. He felt very in tune. But the team didn't gel, and he had been asked to keep an eye on Maradona because Menotti knew Maradona was, you know, kind of could do with having a mature, intelligent, grounded person. So Ozzy talks about, you know, the day they went off to visit a church in a small town, or conversations they had. And but I think the whole post World Cup war and ill feeling between England and Argentina just sank in slowly afterwards. And then again, Tottenham wanted him back, but they agreed he would take a while to come back and just rest in Argentina. And he slowly realised that it was just too difficult. But he loved England, and his kids had been born there, and he was completely kind of torn. I think he suffered it on a personal level a lot more. And as I say, I think professionally it affected Ricky a lot more. But during the World Cup itself, it's difficult to know. I mean, different players say different things. And for example, Tarantini, who also played in England briefly, actually, between 78 and 82, and he had a very complicated life, and later in life was embroiled in all sorts of drug scandals with Maradona. And, you know, he was a clubber, and he had a supermodel girlfriend and so on. But he's very emotional when he remembers just that shock of leaving Argentina, thinking the situation was one, and reaching Spain and realizing it was so different from the point of view of what the press said about the war. And he knew kids who were out at the front, and he was completely hounded by that. But then other players who went on to play in 86, so 82 is like an intersection of two generations. They just laugh about it a lot and say it was a shambles. We were all just clubbing and partying all night. Menotti, you know, I remember Menotti like just rock and rolling with a big pint in his hand, and there were girls all the time. So if you...
So Menotti was sending Ozzy and Maradona off to church while he was hitting the clubs.
Well, don't quote me on that, because Menotti might well just dispute it. And I'm just saying what some rumours say, and absolutely allegedly, and there's no evidence whatsoever.
Well, if you look at I'm looking back at the press reports and the reporting at the time, it is reported that Menotti, there's a certain amount of traffic in and out of his hotel room and his hotel, the area where he is, let's put it that way. But it's interesting that you mentioned Ardiles and Tarantini, actually, because I feel Ardiles has had an excellent World Cup in 1982.
He was the standout Argentine player against Belgium, even in the first day. Yeah.
I mean, you know, for a guy that, you know, as you say, Marcelo, maybe it was in time these things kind of dawned on him, but he just hit the ground running. And in fact, I would put, if I was, you know, listing off players, Argentinian players who played, I would put Tarantini in the top three or four as well. He's had an excellent tournament. He was very good. He was like, he was aggressive and sassy against Italy, but he did an awful lot of very good technical things as well, for a guy who may well have been going through a degree of emotional turmoil. So these guys, as you said at the top, these guys are classy players. As you say, it just seems like everything just didn't quite click, unfortunately.
It's so difficult to know exactly what it is that turns a bunch of individual amazing players into a not very good team. And I think if we could put our finger on it, then, you know, the entire experience of watching would be completely different, because everybody would just make it happen. Personally, I think that's an interesting World Cup precisely because of that, because it's a kind of shift between one set of winners and another that are coming in, and they're not quite finding that method that works. And as you say, Ardiles was superb, and I think he acknowledges that he was at absolute top of his game, which is why I think he subsequently became quite depressed, because in a way, having a not great World Cup but then returning to Tottenham and doing incredibly well would have just been fantastic for him. I think he was relishing playing. It feels like that was cut with the kind of added background of the story between both nations, which he says, my birth country and my and the country I love. So there's no, you know, maybe another player would have just thought, oh, well, this country's the enemy and I'm going back home. But he was genuinely conflicted, and possibly is still to this day.
I don't imagine in the history of the great Brazil-Argentina games that any other one has been played in a ground as small as Sarria. And it made for an amazing atmosphere.
Well, you've caught me unawares. I don't remember the stadium being particularly small or the atmosphere. I mean, I recently moved to England myself, so I watched probably on English telly. I can't even remember if it was shown, actually. But and everything I've read since, and all the interviews I've done, and I think I've probably interviewed at least half that squad over and over again, I don't think I've ever heard that mentioned.
44,000 in the second stadium in Barcelona for what is one of the great football contests, as Billy Joe mentioned. Like, that rivalry stands out above all other international rivalries.
If that happened now, you would just have an outcry of protest, totally, wouldn't you? If you said, we're going to put Argentina, Brazil, or whatever in the tiniest stadium in Barcelona. I don't know why I always thought it was at the Camp Nou, which of course wasn't yet the Camp Nou as we know it. But I suppose, yes, it's kind of an outrage. At the same time, how many people went to World Cup games back then? I mean, I know the Maracanã took 200,000 back in 1950. And in Argentina, we filled big stadiums. Some games were in very small stadiums, actually, in 78. But tickets were hard to come by, and people didn't travel as much either. So you basically had the local crowd. I suppose in Spain, you might have had a lot of European fans traveling, but was it like now that you go, oh, let's just all the family go off trips halfway around the world and spend more money than some people make in a year? I don't know.
Marcella, you mentioned about maturity and immaturity, and I suppose my takeaway from Maradona's performance was that there was a lack of maturity. But I am kind of fascinated about the relationship he has with anyone. His relationship with the likes of Passarella and Ardiles, players who are obviously, you know, would have to be legends in Argentina, even at that stage in the middle of their careers. And even how Menotti managed that in terms of, you know, was there any way to discipline him? And he was seen as like the chosen one, even at 21 years of age.
So I think what's really interesting about Maradona's relationship to other players generally, but to the international players of that generation, is that he was, first of all, people say he was the best teammate ever. Like, anyone who's shared a pitch with him or a dressing room just say he was kind, patient, generous, he would do things for people on the pitch, off the pitch, in training. So I don't think he was a prima donna with his peers. I think that was very much something he put on for society at large and the world against him and his kind of bravado, the press especially. But the other thing I think it's relevant is that he was by no means a newcomer. He had already played with a 78 squad quite a lot before the World Cup, and it was slightly a surprise and a shock to him that Menotti decided not to play him. I mean, I have a kind of my own personal theory about the emotional intelligence of managers who spot young kids who aren't quite ready, and I think José Peckerman, with regard to Messi in 2006, is probably similar, and I think they see something that we don't and think this kid could be, actually, his potential could be curtailed by playing them too soon or putting them in a high-pressure situation. And I think Menotti says that about Maradona. He says he thought about it a lot, but he had the squad he wanted, and he just felt that just short of his 18th birthday, it was too risky. And he presumably saw stuff about Maradona that we didn't or didn't know. But the point is, Maradona knew the guys. He'd played with them. He'd played on and off with them a lot, internationals, and he'd been in the concentración, which is these kind of really long stretches of time where they all, you know, following from Eleni Herrera to name another Argentine often forgotten, you know, this idea that you have to kind of eat, breathe and think football for a specific amount of time. And then the 79 Youth World Cup was a huge kind of turning point. So Maradona would have got to know the younger kids as well and been a teammate with them. And he absolutely relished all the, you know, the joking and the banter and the sharing, the living quarters and all of that. So I don't think there was an issue about Maradona not helping the team gel. I think I meant more, and I think that's what the players mean more, that they didn't gel as a system on the pitch. Because some of those friendships are incredibly tight to this day, you know, especially the 78 crew and the 86 crew. And there wasn't a massive kind of fallout or rupture there in 82. I mean, Maradona's relationship with Passarella then became contentious over time, and by 1986 exploded because they were both very similar and cocky and wanted to lead and be the captain and so on. And there were other issues too in 86 that contributed to the spat among them. But in 82, I think they were really wanting it. It was more, in 78, they all played in Argentina except Kempes, who played in Spain. And by 86, they were all really more international. And 82, again, it was this mix, you know. And then Valdano, who was going to be the linchpin because he already was in Spain, couldn't play at the last minute. And he had been crucial in the 79 World Cup. So, yeah, it's really interesting. But as I say, the friendships among them have remained to this day. And in fact, well, there's a little bit of rivalry because I think often we consider the 86 World Cup winners as more heroic somehow, or we like that victory more because it hasn't got that dark weight of the military dictatorship and the political propaganda on it. Although both have been slightly tarnished by rumours of uncompetitive behaviours. Maradona's is somehow transparent and on the pitch and we can all see it, whereas the 78 allegations are more sinister and darker and the players themselves are kind of out of it. So obviously they deny it and they deny knowing anything about it. But in 82, we had none of that. It was just the kind of war, which is a visible, real thing happening in the real world that everybody knew. And the football, which everybody wanted to be somehow like in 78, a moment of joy and respite. And it didn't quite happen. And I think, well, if the rumours of the partying and the living it up are true, maybe they were actually having quite a laugh and then just, you know, hang over. And that worked against them. But that, I don't think there were real issues that are so well documented as they were in 86, where they kept having meetings and summits and there were bad, you know, there were one team and another, and then they discuss and this and that, and then Passarella went home, and all of that was much more, I don't know, it was much more in the open. No one refers to 82 as it having being a tournament where there were problems in the dressing room. It's more that they just didn't operate properly on the pitch. And as I say, it's only two games, because two games were fine. I mean, not both results weren't fine, but the football they were able to play was good. And that's ultimately all they aim to do.
And Maradona in particular, I mean, in the Hungarian game has one of his, I hate using the word iconic because it's just so overused, but it is a magnificently brilliant performance. Like, it has everything that you would like to see and remember about him. I just wonder, just to illustrate for people a little bit, I mean, we spoke a little bit on the show about Maradona's life around this time, that he was carrying an injury into the tournament. There was obviously a lot of pressure on him at home in terms of the military seeing him as a something of a poster boy for the junta. And obviously he's got the move to Barcelona teed up and ready to go after this World Cup. I'm just wondering, what was his life like at the time? Was it chaotic? Was it out of control? Or what was it like from going into that World Cup?
Maradona's life was undoubtedly extremely chaotic. Every single minute of every single day, I think, without doubt. He went to Barcelona. It was massive news and a development here. And we, you know, it was said it was $6 million transfer. And at the time, there was this really popular TV series about the $6 million man. And so I remember a lot of kind of comparisons to that. Like, he had nuclear powers in his legs or something.
I'd say it was the first and only time that Lee Majors and Diego Maradona were ever put in the one pod.
For us, we grew up thinking, you know, Maradona was Lee Majors in real life. I mean, but it was, you know, the headlines and it just seemed like so much money as well. Unspeakable amounts. And then he then said himself that in Barcelona he discovered drugs, but he was involved in all sorts of kind of high profile things, including anti-drug campaigns, which are quite funny if you find posters and things. And he had a bad time there. He'd run into conflict with, you know, the powers that be at the club. His life was chaotic, and he was beginning to show himself publicly as somebody who is problematic or whose emotional state would determine his behavior, right? Like super highs and super lows and so on. But again, on the pitch, that never seemed to impact badly, even the drug taking. As he says, can you imagine what kind of a player I might have been if I wasn't on drugs? Because he didn't consume recreational drugs to play. He was, completely on it when it came to training and playing. And that's what everyone says, that he worked really hard to perfect himself. He went to training and so on at the time that suited him. But so he was already embroiled in a lot of high profile, very much press covered issues, and he was losing his cool and running into trouble. But the World Cup felt like it might kind of bring him down to earth, or as Ossie says, you know, they drive around and go to visit small villages and churches with their wives, or Maradona's girlfriend, who then became his wife. And I don't think there's any kind of scandalous thing that Maradona did, particularly in 82. I think it was really, I mean, in a way, I suppose it's a really interesting tournament for Argentina, because it was entirely about what happened on the pitch. Like, there were massive issues out of it, but ultimately that was it. You know, they went on, and I think that the consistent marking he suffered against Italy, and the pain, and the, you know, the surprise he felt that it was possible to stop him with such kind of devious, you know, non-footballing tactic.
I'm amazed he was surprised, to be honest. I'm surprised that you say he was surprised. I would have thought, I mean, okay, Gentile, I know he's a level, he's another level, but still in all, I mean, this was, you know, there was an element of this punishment that surely he knew, and coming into a game like that, it was always going to be amplified against Italy.
Well, I don't know if he was surprised. I'm just kind of relaying my piecing together of the sequence of things, but I think it, to the extent that FIFA, you know, decided to start being harsher on those kinds of fouls, I think it was a turning point in how we all perceived. I think we were all surprised, because you kind of, it wasn't just that they fouled him so vehemently and viciously, but also that there was no play at all practically, or at least that's how he perceived it, and how, you know, Argentina's reconstructed history is like, well they wouldn't let Maradona play. And obviously the Gentile incident is another level. But, and then I think some against Brazil, it's almost like we just got a glimpse of the Maradona that was to become prevalent, if you like. You know, I don't care and I'm furious and I hate everybody and now I'm just going to beat someone up, whoever it happens to be. I remember him saying, "I'm sorry, you're the wrong guy. You know, apologies. It wasn't you. It's not you, it's me." But it was still, it was still the end of the dream, as it were. But at the same time, you know, a team that's functioning. I mean, it's interesting because by the final in 1986, everybody's understood that this can happen. And they're all ready and they've studied every single set piece and exactly where they need to be on the pitch. And everybody knows what they're going to do because they're fully expecting Maradona to take away all the mark and carry them with him. But that's like years later and several games later. So Italy and Brazil were real. I guess they were the first real Maradona internationally. And what we all come to expect since then of massive international games with one big star in them or you know.
I really am interested in, as best as you can give us a description of it, and maybe it's very hard for you to do this, how much of an added impact was a World Cup exit to what was going on in Argentina at the time? It's an extremely difficult period for Argentinian people, I'd say, and there must have been this huge hope that a bit of football success will just give us a sense of pride, and then they lose. Did it add to it? Did it have an effect? Was there a confluence, is that the word, of events there?
So, well, again, it's kind of something we reconstruct over time rather than a fresh memory of the moment. I mean, I lived far away and my contacts was mainly through my dad who lived in Argentina, and we always spoke about football throughout my whole life. And then suddenly that summer we were talking about a war just as much. And I think it was a difficult time, but it was also a complete transition towards democracy. People had had enough. They'd had enough of the military. In fact, the entire Falklands, Malvinas conflict was triggered by a massive demonstration against the government 2 days before Galtieri decided to send troops into the islands, because the mood was there to stop that and to, you know, it had been, you know, since 1976, this military government had taken over. Its time had come. And so immediately after the World Cup and the surrender in the Falklands and that winter, which it was in Argentina, which is the European summer of 82, the transition to democracy began. And there were democratic elections for the first time in all those years, and by the beginning of the following year, a democratic government was in place, and within a year, the military were tried in a civil court. And I mean, there's a lovely film about that that's just come out now called Argentina 1985. You know, we became the first democracy in the world to actually try a military regime for its crimes against humanity. And so that whole process was super ecstatic. I guess it was comparable to Franco's end in Spain and what they call the destape, which literally means taking a lid off something. So again, I think the World Cup 82 has become an anecdote in a much, much bigger process, a social process. And, you know, I can't highlight enough quite how big a deal it was to win the World Cup again in 86, because we then had this bookends to this turmoily time in 82, but it was a happy conclusion. We'd won a World Cup, we had a not so great World Cup, and we won a World Cup, and therefore we were arguably the best in the world at football, and also we'd reclaimed our democracy and had a healthy social, you know, society going on, and the youth were really engaged with democratic processes, and it was quite an elation. So it's not like, oh, we lost the World Cup and therefore everything was over. It was like a Maradona himself became, you know, again flourished and went to Napoli, and his own story also took off. So there was no real massive downer about the football. I think for the 78 players, maybe yes, because that marked a little bit the end of their playing careers. But even Passarella, who ended worst off by getting kicked out of 86 by then super feisty Maradona, who was the new captain, also actually embarked upon a massive and successful career in football. Like, you know, he became manager of Argentina, manager of River Plate, president of River Plate. So he's an incredibly divisive and contentious figure, but absolutely a guy who has, you know, succeeded by any definition of the word in football. And I think that's what we like. I mean, he himself once said to me, in football, that's the only area where we can look at Europeans and first world in the eye as equals. We're a match for them. And that, so we're not underdogs, we're not third worlders or southern global south developing, you know, country. We are equals, and he is super feisty, competitive, you know, captain. We called him the Kaiser, and he's studs out, as we say, and charges on. So even for him, it wasn't a terrible ending or a sinking in a depressive state or anything particularly awful. I think it was very much a transition between one football manager and another, one World Cup and another, one appalling kind of political regime and a democracy, and a real moment of transition in the country's story, which was accompanied by football. And it's a little bit of a cliche, but I think football reflects reality and reflects society. And the 1982 World Cup in particular reflected Argentina's transitional point in time.
Listen, really appreciate your time, Marcelo. Hope to have you back on when we do 1986 one day at a time. But it sounds like you're going to be on like multiple episodes.
Bloody hell,
Marcelo, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marcelo.
Thank you.
Argentina 1, Brazil 3.
It's one-sided, Billy Joe, but I think what was critical for Argentina's performance here was that the early goal, the free kick, it killed a decent enough start for Argentina trying to ease their way into the game. The mesmerizing free kick is what launches us into this football match.
I think you're right. I think, look, we spoke on the last episode about this weird group situation where one team isn't playing. So you lose the first one, you're back at it again 3 or 4 days later, and you feel under pressure to get the win. So and Argentina started like a team that had that motivation. they had the better of the opening 10 minutes. I can't remember, was it Calderon that had a headed opportunity?
Calderon with the first one, yeah.
Yeah, and there was another one then where Maradona does this audacious flick off the outside of his left boot back in field where Tarantini, like, you would never have scored. There was never enough pace on the ball to generate enough power to trouble Perez in the Brazil goal. But, like, they really did have the better of those 10 minutes. What I noticed about it as well is that compared to some of the other games so far, is their defensive line was much higher up the field. And now when you look back at it, you'll think, well, that was a big mistake when you consider who you're playing against and the way a couple of the goals, you know, in the second half played out. But just to speak of that goal, I can't remember the foul, but it's still 35 yards out. And people have to understand, we're watching these on old broadcasts. I think I was watching definitely a Spanish version, and the ball is put down, and, you know, you think free kick, and you're kind of thinking, is this Zico territory? Probably a bit too far out for that. So you're thinking, okay, Zico is not likely to hit it. And then Eder comes from out of screen. His run up, it's like as if Roberto Carlos.
Closer to the mic there, boy. Closer to the mic.
Yeah, it's like that famous goal in the competition that means nothing that we keep seeing from Roberto Carlos, where he hits it, where he runs from, like, his own penalty spot to hit this free kick against France in Le Tournoi, in whenever that was, and
that's
makes
exactly
the ball
what
move
I thought
about
of.
6 foot. But Adair comes in and absolutely smashes it with a bit of outside of the left swerve as well. And in all fairness to Phil Hall, I feel I've been giving out about him all through the World Cup. He does get a touch on this, and he touches it onto the crossbar. But as so often is the case, the two players that are there to tap it in are Zico and Serginho. Zico gets there first, taps it in, and it's one into Brazil, and you know it's gone then.
I was looking at that going, for God's sake, Serginho can't even get to the tap-in.
Zico gets the tap-in.
This man is cursed. Like, he was ahead of Zico when that ball hits the crossbar and Zico gets in for the goal. So now, where that leads is, later in the game, you're going, how on earth did they let Serginho score?
But just for one more second on that free kick, I just want to understand today, again, Billy Joe, as to then, like, is Eder some sort of, like, he is a freak of nature. Is what he's doing with a football there just, it's not going to happen very often in our lifetimes that we're going to see free kicks like this. Is that what it is, or what else is happening?
I think that, look here, I'm no physics expert, but I think, and this is my own, and you know me long enough, Rob.
I was wondering what the E equals MC squared on the door behind you was.
Definitely not. But I have a theory on everything, as you know, Rob. And I just think that the football, what was it called in 82? What was the name of the Adidas football?
The Tango.
Tango. I think that ball was heavier. And there, when you strike across a ball like that with your left boot, it's not going to move as much, and probably moves in a truer fashion and swerves away. Whereas I think it's much more difficult now for players to hit those balls. They're lighter, they move so much, and actually be able to control that. Because if you talk about the strike of Ramon Diaz's goal, the consolation goal in this game, they're two very similar strikes.
Yeah.
I think there's another element to that Eder free kick as well. And Fiala does do well on the free kick, but he's very slow to get up and turn around. Like, it hits the ball, if the ball hits the crossbar, bounces down, Zico, Serginho are straight in. I think Fiala is slightly bewildered by what's just
the fact that he saved it,
happened.
Or the fact that he came at him.
I think he thought, I actually think he may have thought he saved it. I think when he got a touch on it, maybe he's not sure where the ball has gone, and he thinks it's gone. But he's so slow. He is very slow. He's to turn around.
So is the entire Argentinian defense.
Well, that's the other thing. There's nobody back. No one comes back, and it's just a tap in. But there is an element. I think there's an element of bewilderment, and it's not surprising that when something like that happens on a football field, it feels otherworldly, a free kick like that. But at this point in the tournament, we're starting to become used to these otherworldly occurrences with Brazil. So Eder smashes one. You also know Eder is going to... I mean, I was watching it and thinking, you know the way they have... There's a thing on YouTube of, you know, Pele playing badly, and there's all these, like, wild shots and this, that, and the other. You could easily do one of those for Brazil 82 as well. Because, I mean, Eder has another handful of shots that's just going nowhere. But he only needs to get it right once, and it's sensational, and he tends to get it right once.
Mick, just in the Daily Mirror's report, they say Brazil not quite yet the 58-70 team, but showing some signs of it. So it's interesting to see just one rider in the moment kind of...
I do think that from watching the tournament now, and particularly in the second phase, maybe this is a conversation for a slightly different time, but
yeah,
it's the games are good and the moments are good, but the second phase is not classic by any means, right?
First phase is better,
it's
yeah.
not at all. Like, it's starting to lag a bit. It's starting to slow down. Yeah. I can see why the guy in the mirror might have said that.
If you take as well, like, this was the team in some respects that's remembered from this tournament is this Brazil team. But if you take the next 50 minutes of this game, they get the breakthrough early. It was, different to the game against USSR, different to the game against Scotland, where they actually go behind. And maybe I'm explaining it in the circumstances myself, because in those games you see the passing, the interplay, the dominance of the ball, the free movement of particularly the midfield players and Adair all over the field, where they don't make a show of Argentina in any way here. They're not, there's no champagne football. They're not, passing it around them. They're not, Argentina are well able to get on the ball and force issues as well. Nowhere near as slick as the Brazilians, but like they are being effective in many ways and robust and Brazil aren't as fluid. And maybe that's because Argentina aren't letting them.
There's a little bit of the dark arts for Brazil here, which surprised me because... in the knowledge that we know something is coming in the next game that's going to surprise us, you're kind of going, oh, if they've got that steel, why don't they see it through?
Well, they go after Maradona the same way anybody else has done. He gets some severe punishment before he eventually gets sent off. Like, he does take some severe punishment. But the
He's
other point of,
for what looked like a penalty.
A blatant penalty. Absolutely blatant penalty. And I was going to include that in this run of chances. So, like... After Brazil go goal up, I count anyway, 1, 2, 3, I count 4 chances that Argentina have, genuine legit chances. Like, Perez makes a very good save from a Passarella header. Maradona plays Ramon Diaz in and he misses it. It's a good chance. There's a clear penalty. Junior takes out Maradona on the edge of the box. It's a clear penalty and doesn't get given. And Ramon Diaz has another great chance, but he shoots wildly wide, like wild wide. And then the next thing we get the second goal. But like, it's not like Billy Joe says, it's not that Argentina were miles out of it. It's just they probably just didn't have the quality to take and just the confidence maybe to take the chances. And if they got that penalty and it had gone 1-1, you wonder.
I think this game could have been 4-4.
Yeah.
Like that's the number of chances. It's just that Brazil were able to put theirs away. And as I reiterate, Serginho scores.
A free header, though, in fairness. It's on a play.
There's not a sinner around him. If this was, on Monday Night Football now, they'd be drawing a big circle around him to prove that there was no defender within an ass's roar of him while he headed that in.
Shout out to, now correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was Falcao that crossed that ball for Serginho for the header.
It was, yeah. Yeah.
And in all fairness to him, he gave an exhibition of arriving late into the box in that first half. Like in the he took one ball
like Billy Joe at parties.
Right. Straight into the fridge for that last can. But and the first one, I think he controls it and he gets away a right footed shot. Neither of them go in really, really quickly. But the second one was a thing of beauty. I love a long range one too. But he plays this ball into Socrates and he's so tall and he kind of cushions this header back to him. And then Falcao hits it first time on left foot on the volley and it just skips the top of the crossbar. It is a thing of beauty.
You're back. We couldn't hear you there. You'd gone so far from the microphone for a second.
Falcao had another terrific game. He's growing into this tournament more and more and more. And you're looking at him now going, this is the guy who could actually, Zico and all the others notwithstanding, it could be Falcao's the one that knits it all together for them,
There was a moment where he had set Serginho up, I think towards the end of the first half, and Serginho does what Serginho does and makes a complete mess of it. But there's a cutaway just immediately afterwards of Falcao, and you can just see the glare he's giving him of, like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you finish
my piece
that?
Of art? Yeah. It's like he's come in and just thrown a bucket of emulsion on this beautiful piece that Falcao has created for him.
Junior's goal, there's beauty in that, Billy Joe, as well.
Oh, Canarino.
Yeah, it's a beautiful through ball, perfect play. And I actually thought, and Mick, I agree completely, Mick, Junior does foul Maradona. It is a penalty, and that's the thing. But he had a great game. I thought he was brilliant up and down. And the minute you see the ball played into him, you think, yeah, he's just going to slot this home. And the run is perfect. The timing of the pass is really good. In some respects, it reminds me of the Cabrini goal, was it against in Italy against Argentina, where he's just there is a weakness, yes, there on that left wing.
Yeah.
And the ball is moved from right to left through the center and get in behind the fullback, and it's a first time finish. So it's obviously something that they worked on throughout. But it's a really good goal also. And which is vitally important, a great goal celebration. Where Junior crafts his hands out and does a little jig and around. It's an iconic goal celebration.
That's the first. Now he's gone off mic for a celebration.
Well, you know why he was celebrating, obviously, because there's a guaranteed spike in single sales. He's back at number one in Brazil, yeah, this weekend, lads. He's back there. Every time there's a World Cup game that summer, his single climbed the charts.
Just as you said, I was looking at Serginho's celebration for his goal because they have it on the screen in the background, and it's just a beaming smile. It's just, this stuff is gone from football. Just people being happy in normal ways.
All jokes aside, you kind of do feel when he gets it, you're just going, oh, thank God for the poor lad. Because can only malign someone so much. There's two major incidents on the Argentinian side after these goals. The first, obviously, is the sending off.
As Mick mentioned earlier, Maradona's totally frustrated at this stage. Look, he's not, things aren't coming off from, he feels totally that the world's against him because he doesn't get that penalty. His teammates, when he's setting them up, haven't been applying the finishing touches, Diaz in particular. And then it is a clear sign to me that his head is gone. I think it's 2-0 at this stage, where he gets the ball literally just inside the 18-yard box, centrally located, and with only the goalkeeper to beat, and he tries to chip Perez. You know, when the play is to just hammer it low into the bottom corner and its goal is 2-1, and just who sees what happens. And then, so for me, his head is gone at that stage, and you can kind of understand what happens after that.
Yeah, like the frustration's building ultimately. Like, and this is the amazing thing, as we talked about it in the Italy game, with all of the abuse he gets, he holds his temper. And then in a game that's not quite as physical, he completely loses it. And I mean, again, we talk about this, you know, how we're consuming it, which is video footage from a VHS that's been digitized via a 10-euro device in Lidl or Aldi that then gets uploaded onto the web. So it's slightly pixelated at times. I couldn't make out who he injured.
Batista, I think it is the sub.
I immediately wanted to check Google to see if that person successfully fathered children afterwards.
Yeah, it was like it was a pretty crude vasectomy, to say the least. Like Batista had nailed some other Brazilian player just literally before. It's basically just studs up straight into the midriff from a standing position. It's like a karate kick. He goes down, and Maradona goes off. You can see he's swearing away to himself. He's gone off, and it's just, you know, it's all over.
The best way we could sum this up, Mick, is for our listeners who are a little bit younger, don't remember the 82 World Cup like ourselves, is the referee walked straight up and showed him a red card without hesitation. 1982, if that happens, you've earned it.
That is, like, to show a red card exactly the way you've just described in 1982, it's one step short of the police coming onto the field and taking him away.
Yeah.
That's the only other place to go.
And if that referee is Mexican.
Yeah. Yes, like, indeed. Which he is.
Everything goes generally in this instance. But, I mean, the thing that caught my attention was they cut to the press box. One side of the stands in Syria all appeared to be occupied by the press because they all appeared to have these little green desks that they'd install in front of the seats.
Yeah.
And for some bizarre reason, they cut to one particular journalist running back to his seat as this occurred, and you're kind of going, what's that fella done that's so significant?
Very strange. Yeah,
it's so many strange things. Socrates gets carried off at one stage by Zico and Serginho, I think, when he was injured, and like they needed to get him off the pitch to get on with the game. There are just things in 1982.
Like Zico, I mean, how much would Zico be worth now, lads, roughly speaking, do you think? What value did you put on Zico?
Well, how much was Kylian Mbappé in his last transfer?
180 something million, I think.
Right, Zico's worth 300 million quid.
Right, so let's say in modern parlance, right, you have 300 million euros worth of talent right there on the field. He takes a terrible tackle, goes down, and he is lifted off the field like a bag of potatoes
by his teammates and dropped
on the other side of the sideline.
Like, most of him, by the way, are worth over 100 million quid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it is really genuinely another planet watching some of this stuff at this point now. It really is.
Well, thanks to Marcelo, we don't need to do a big wrap on Argentina because we've done that. They are done, out of it. It's Italy or Brazil into the semi-finals. And, you know, I'm sure that's going to be a very tight, tense and dull affair. That's all I can say on that one. But maybe tune in just in case it's better than that. Who knows? Yeah. Next game. Oh, before we go to next game, like, just to reiterate, we mentioned already, the ground is what it was. I just loved to hear a story from someone who was sitting on the balcony or on the rooftop, which was packed. There was actual Brazilian flags on the rooftops of the flats that were overlooking that ground. That is atmosphere.
Well, that ground, sorry, was vacated in 1997. The club could no longer maintain it, Espanyol. And I think at that stage they moved into the 92 Olympic Stadium.
They went to the Olympic Stadium.
They were in much more salubrious surroundings once they moved, because that stadium, if you've ever been to Barcelona, is in the middle of Montjuic Park. Whereas Sarria was a neighbourhood. And as you say, tower blocks all around the ground. It just had,
savage.
It was sensational. And the crowd are crammed in. Like, as we said there earlier, like, how could they not have made the exception and moved that game to the Camp Nou?
Enough of this. Next game.
West Germany 2, Spain 1.
West Germany knock Spain out of the World Cup. It kind of took a while to build the drama in this one, Mick, but when it built, well, it was pretty sensational stuff, as Spain just fell to their knees, although they did rattle the cage a little bit at the end.
Yeah, they did their best. Like, that's about as much as you could say about them. You mentioned the atmosphere there. I mean, it was fraught. I mean, it's the one, you know, it's the one atmosphere. It's in the Bernabeu. It is packed. You can practically see the steam rising off of the crowd. This was another one of those, by the way, starring moments for the travel company who were dealing with the ticket situation and all. Wow. Like, apparently the scene outside the Bernabeu before this match was just like people trying to clamber on board life rafts for the Titanic or something. It was just like women with babes in arms lifting them up and fellas running around trying to grab
any
tickets.
Any idea of the official attendance, Mick?
Oh, well, 90,000, I think, wasn't it, was probably the attendance.
99 in some sources is what they're saying.
Here you go. So what you had inside, you had a big issue with duplicate tickets. Like, people were going up to their seats and finding two or more people standing thinking, and they had precisely identical tickets. They didn't even look like forgeries. It just looks like the travel company who were organising all this, who've already made a complete arse of it, were printing duplicate tickets on top of everything else. In fact, there was one guy, there was a story of a German guy in full-on Bavarian gear, like the lederhosen, the whole lot, going around with a Spanish flag around the Bernabeu. And the reason he had a Spanish flag was because occasionally he would throw it on the ground, spit on it, and start swearing in Spanish and all this sort of stuff. So, I mean, the atmosphere was just, it was through the roof.
I'm going to assume then that there were lots of people sitting on each other's knees, which explained the raucous atmosphere. But even the camera angles in this game, they scan the upper decks of the stands so that that's all you can see at times. And it feels like the Circus Maximus in Gladiator.
I remember standing, I mean, this is a bit of a local analogy, but I remember standing on the stage of the Olympia Theatre in Dublin one time, and the way the stage in the Olympia Theatre, well, the way the stalls, it goes up into the ceiling when you're standing on. You don't see the ceiling, you just see a wall of people. And it's like that here. the way Ciarán has described it, the way the camera goes, it's like the crowd just go up into the sky. It's like it goes on forever.
Yeah.
And it's an extraordinary sight and an amazing piece of theatre in all in of itself. The game is, I would say, not an amazing piece of theatre, but it is intriguing to some degree. Like, when you think about it coming into it, the Spanish obviously are coming off the back of losing to Northern Ireland. The coach is Emilio Santa Maria, who's a Uruguayan, but he did play with Real Madrid throughout the 50s and on. He's coming back to Madrid now. They've come away from Valencia and they're now back in Madrid. So there's pressure there. But he sees weakness in the Germans. Like, he says Germany are very nervous. Their style, like England, he says, is forced. Ours is faster. And what we'll try to do is make them play the rhythm we impose. So, you know, he's going to try to do that. Like, they
nothing
do...
like some mind games leading into a group, is there?
Mind games, I know. Like, I mean, they bring in Santillana and Keeney. They're their two star strikers. I mean, Keeney is the top scorer in Spain that year for Barcelona. I'll come back to Keeney if that's all right later on. But
yes,
from the German side of things, there are rumours of dissent. Things are not good. They're in the second round, but people are not happy. Like, it was a nil-all draw against England. I mean, and when you think about it, like, they completely bamboozled England by just putting an extra player in midfield, as we discussed in the previous round, which, when you think about it now, probably hinted at a severe weakness in England, that they couldn't even respond to that. And I mean, their German response to their kind of non-performance in that game up to the last 10 minutes was pretty strong. And so what they do for this game is they just flip it all again. They go, okay, we're not going to go defensive. Pierre Littbarski comes back in. Franz Fischer, who's a very good striker, comes in. Reinders, who's a kind of more defensive midfielder, goes out. And Hansi Müller, who was seen to be some kind of a saviour to come in and energise the whole thing, he didn't against England, is gone. So now they're a much more, it's more back to what you might have seen against Chile, for example, in the group stage. They're a bit more, well, they're just a bit more attacking looking, and there's a little bit more about them.
Before I, let Billy move in and out from that microphone describing Pierre Littbarski and Fisher's goals, I must point out the number of players with their socks down and no shin guards at a time when shins were basically, goals were one target in a game and shins were the other.
Yeah.
Ludicrous behaviour.
Like, you had Gordillo, the left back. You had Briegel, the left back. Littbarski, who got kicked more than most. But, like, actually, I don't know what she thought. I mean, maybe I'm just completely scarred by the Northern Ireland-Spain game. I didn't think Spain were as violent in this game. Or maybe it was the Germans just didn't give them a chance to be as violent. I don't know. They did. There was a few moments, you know, but by and large. I mean, in fact, it was Juanito, the most creative player on the Spanish team, who got kicked out of the game before halftime.
Oh, that's why he went off, of course, yeah.
Forster absolutely hammers him.
But that's strategic. I think the approach to him was strategic because this is his temple, baby. You know what
yes,
I mean?
True, yeah.
And,
yeah,
and if you want to quiet the Spanish crowd, you're going to have to take him out of it in Madrid.
I think it's quite deliberate what Germany do here. They really focus on that, their own left side and the right side of the Spanish defence. Like, Littbarski from the first moment he's brilliant. He's the best player on the field. Like, it's a dramatic turnaround. You know, he's well supported by Briegel as rampaging, and they seem to have a good understanding that if Littbarski was wide, Briegel kind of went, like you see a lot in modern day football with foot, you know, people coming from a deeper position and going straight at the goals as opposed to overlapping. I think they call it underlapping now, coming inside Littbarski and getting involved in that way. And you, in this game as well, you see the real Paul Breitner. Like, Paul Breitner is
superb,
like a real midfield general there. There's a lovely piece of skill in the first half. And I think it's important to note that in terms of the mentality of the Germans as well, that they lose Rummenigge at halftime as well. And like, but there's a piece of interplay between himself and Littbarski early on where the ball is running out of play and Rummenigge just gets there in time. And it's not a back heel, it's kind of a back flip into the path of Littbarski, but it's such a hard skill because the ball is like 6 inches off the ground and he just feathers the ball back into Littbarski's path and he gets a shot away and unfortunately goes wide. But I think you see so much more creativity generally all down the German left side with those players interacting. And that's the real quality in the game.
And also from our old friend Tony Schumacher, I think he has a very good game. A very good game. He makes a brilliant save from Santillana in the first half. And he's bowling that ball out, you know.
Yeah, his distribution is superb. It's very modern kind of skill, yeah.
He plays very well. So it's coming together. Now, it's not like that they're, you know, they're not brilliant in this game or anything. But you can see elements of a decent German team coming together. And no more than the French, far away on the other side of the draw, looking at them. They're kind of evolving into something. But, I mean, ultimately this game turns in some respects on the Spanish goalkeeper, I think.
Unquestionably. Some horrendous errors, huge pressure on them, obviously, because the nature of this, you know, they're playing the team that are now favourites for this group, effectively, okay? So if West Germany win this game, Spain's World Cup is over and they still have to play another match. Like, yeah. That's the absurdity of this system. The home nation are going to play a dead rubber against a team that needs to win to progress.
That's nuts. It's absolutely nuts. I mean, they do. I mean, it's probably Spain's, I would say it's Spain's best performance. Maybe their Yugoslav game, maybe.
Unquestionably better than any than we've seen them throughout this tournament. And I think that's the move to Madrid as well.
I do, yeah. I think the crowd is more, and it's just, everything is more. But it ultimately comes back to Arconada. Arconada, who at this point, and has been spoken about through the tournament as one of the world's best goalkeepers, a hero from the 1980 Euros. Also a poster boy for the 1982 World Cup. If you were in Spain, Madrid, around that time, he was on every poster. He was advertising everything from chewing gum to cars. So he's a very big presence here. But as we know, he's already panned one out to Gerry Armstrong for Northern Ireland's goal. And here he has a shot from Dremler about 4 minutes into the second half that he fumbles and it rolls out. And Litbarski's right there to finish the rebound. Now, the Spanish defence were also a bit slow to get back in with Litbarski, but shouldn't have come to it. Arconada should have put that away. If he wasn't going to be able to hold it himself, he should have been put away to the wing somewhere. But that 1-0 throws him back. It's a good response now. The Spanish respond well, I think. But they never really put the screw on the Germans between the 49th minute and the 75th minute when Germany go 2-0.
And that goal, Billy Joe, that second goal is the masterpiece of this game.
It is, and again, it's the, you know, two of the key players for Germany. Breitner, in his arrogant sort of strut, striding up the field, and he plays a vertical pass right in between, I can't remember, was it in between the two centre-backs or in between a centre-back and a full-back, and Litbarski's making that diagonal run, he's onside, and then it's all about his awareness. He knows, you know, the goalkeeper's advancing on him. He knows there's a defender on his shoulder. And instead of taking a shot first time, he lets the ball run past himself, uses his right foot to bring it back round it, all the way around inside, sees the goalkeeper coming out, knows he can't get a shot, and he just toe-pokes it into the path of Fischer, who then has, what seems like an age to beat the defender who's gone back to try and defend it on the line. I think he takes two touches before
he almost has too much time. When he takes the first touch, you're going, no, you idiot, you've just... Oh, defender's doing nothing. And then he just... Like, it's so nonchalant, the second touch. It's like the defender hasn't advanced. I think the defender is a deer and Fischer is headlights. Like, it's just literally... You just go, the touch, you've completely buggered. Oh, no. Oh, oh yeah, just pick your spot. Wait, yeah, no, that's fine.
It's fine.
Like his energy output in that goal is 85% celebration, 15% the goal.
Yeah. But it works. Look, 2-0. And, you know, again, there's not an enormous response from the Spanish initially. But, if, you know, 5 or 6 minutes later, one good cross. And Billy Joe, you will have enjoyed that header. It's like from about 15 yards out, Zamora, isn't it?
No, he's excited.
It is one of these ones where, like, I know in the modern technology now, there, you know, there should be some way of putting GIFs up on like a dictionary. The football dictionary of towering header should be a GIF
of Zamora attacking that ball.
Absolutely.
And look, just powering it from about 19 yards into the far corner, looping and over and into the corner. It's a wonderful thing to see that header. And you know what? It's a bloody great celebration as well, because I think he just stands there with his hands straight up in the air. It's brilliant.
But ultimately now worth less than cryptocurrency. Because their goose is cooked. Everybody, that heaving crowd leaves the Bernabeu, and they know that Spain must now play a game against England where England can qualify and they can't.
Just one point on that, Ciarán. Just there's one other attack after that where they get a half shot blocked down, and it's one of those classic pre-noughties moments where the stadium is rocking so much that the camera starts to shake. Yeah. And you're like, you suddenly just in that one moment get it like a parallel universe. What would that stadium have been like, Mick, if they had got an equalizer?
It would have been unbelievable, because even through the 40 years, through the dodgy transfer of the VHS, through the thing and onto the internet and all the rest of it, you could feel the noise, like you really can. There's another moment. That's Alonso, Xabi Alonso's dad. But I don't even think he got the shot off, really. I mean, it wasn't really going to go anywhere. But there was a moment a couple of minutes later that really could have shifted the tectonic plate. So there was a corner. No, that was a corner. Free kick, sorry. From Camacho that went up high into midair. And Alisenko, the assassin from the Northern Ireland game, who did a fair bit of kicking in this match as well, went up for a header with Tony Schumacher. And they met in midair. And I was just looking at it going, this could go any which way. Like, this could go any which way. But it didn't go anywhere. I was kind of a little bit disappointed and relieved all at
the
one time.
That's one of those ones where you're going, damn, why don't they have slow motion replay?
Yeah, like, I mean, that's two serious operators at a certain level of the game meeting each other right there. But look, that was it. Silence.
That's Bull McCabe inviting the Yanklings to the field, I'm telling you.
It's time for Team of the Day. Four teams on paper. How could you pick a team from it? But it was a day where some players played well and some didn't, Ciarán.
Right, okay, I'm going to make this really quick.
Sounds like a very unusual situation in a football game, Rob. Some people play well, others don't.
Did you ever see the abbreviated Shakespeare Company, did you? You know, where they compress Shakespeare plays into like two-minute monologues. I'm going to do that for the team of the day today. This one's been a challenge, okay?
Okay, go.
So, the goalkeeper should be relatively simple, should it not?
I would say Schumacher.
Yes. In. Right back.
I'm just going to say we have Junior and I think Briegel, who played very, very well.
I think those are our two fullbacks.
Or fullbacks. So yeah. Like, who would you like? Kals. I had Kals down as well, but I think Briegel and Junior were so good. Could stick Briegel over on the right. Or Junior would probably be better on the right because he could
put Junior on the right and leave Briegel on the left. And yeah.
I love how we take this stuff seriously. Like, this will never actually happen.
Yeah, this would be terrible now if bookmakers were taking odds on the one day at a time team of the day and realised how little thought we give to it.
We've got to get the balance right of this team of pensioners, you know? Right. Who's your centre halves? Or sweepers? I don't know what you're thinking.
I thought...
Think abbreviated Shakespeare Company.
Sorry. Passarella.
You had a great game.
Yeah. Hang on, I'm just going to put the teams in front of me.
Billy Joe's laughing. Could be in agreement or in disagreement.
I think that Brazil deserve a little bit of defensive credit. It was probably Walter Perez's best game in goals as well, even though Schumacher was much better. So I'd be inclined to throw Luizinho in there at centre back.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I like him. I think he's a good
centre
back.
One German, one Brazilian, one Argentinian.
We do. So we're on to midfield now, and I think
two Brazilians we've got in there. Yeah, yeah. Luizinho and Junior.
Yeah, and if you're going for a 4-4-2, look, I
Lebarski.
Well, he's out left for sure. Yeah, mm-hmm. He was out absolutely outstanding. And then if you go across the midfield that way, like Falcao is in there at centre mid, like he was the best midfielder on show.
I think you can put Ardiles in there again if you wanted to. I really do.
I thought he was good.
Yeah, I would put him in there. Yeah.
Now maybe you know Breitner could be in there. You know. And he's close to the end of his career. Like he was there in 1974 with Germany. Like you know, so it's yeah. He's a.
Some beard and head of hair on him is still in those days. I tell you what.
Okay, so that's Breitner. So up top, we've gone for two. Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I make a shout here? But I was really impressed by and have been throughout this tournament by the young man from Argentina called Ramon Diaz.
Okay.
I thought he scored a cracker of a free in this game, and I thought his general play was outstanding. For a kid that, you know, made his league debut only a few weeks after the previous World Cup final, you know, Marcelo talked about the young guys coming through from that 79 U Championship. Mm-hmm. He's one of them, and he's impressed me throughout. Although I would wonder why Maradona never seems to pass to him when they were supposed to be telepathic in 79.
Yeah, no, it's a phenomenal goal. He could add a couple more with it. Like, I'm happy with him up there. And as you see the way I got excited about that towering header, towering header. I don't care for that header alone. I don't even know if Zamora touched the ball the rest of the game, but that one touch with his head was good enough for me.
And here I thinking you were going for Serginho.
So she still can't get in.
Damn it,
even though he scored a goal.
To the ball again.
Like, yeah. And here's an interesting one though. For the team you've just picked, right?
No Zico, no Socrates.
Yeah. And an equal number
Maradona.
Of Argentinians and Brazilians, even though the Brazilians pretty well comfortably won that game. Interesting.
As I said, that game could have been 4-0.
1-2. And hang on, 1-2-3. Actually, the Germans are the dominant team on this day. That's interesting to me.
Well,
no one else, but it's interesting to me.
This is the game where Germany go up a level. So,
This not the cue for another reading from the book of Schumacher?
And just before we read that book, because it's the last we mentioned, Ramon Diaz never played for Argentina again after this World Cup.
Wow.
What?
That's incredible.
I know.
Incredible.
Check it out.
Incredible. I mean, there was talk that, I mean, there was always talk to himself that Maradona didn't get on or fallen out or something, wasn't there? But there's another version of the story.
Gone for the walks to the churches with Ozzy.
Should have stayed. He should have been in the back seat. But they should. There's another story to say that Maradona canvassed for him to be there in 86 and 1990, but she didn't make it. There we go.
A reading from the book of our team of the day goalkeeper, Tony Schumacher. Do you want a random page?
Always guarantees to provoke thought, comment, emotions, all those things. Pick a number between 1 and 214. Anybody?
213.
Jesus.
You know, any book has to have a conclusion. You know, like you reach a climax, resolution. So he can't be saying anything contentious in the resolution section of the book.
This is testing this whole platform here.
Okay, you're going to have to give me obviously a second here. Just give me a second.
It's actually the bibliography, is it?
No, it's not. No, we're okay. It's all about English football, actually, would you believe? I'm going to have to give a little context to this line. I don't like doing it, but I will. He's talking about English football and the lack of creativity in English football, apart from the two lads who are playing in Germany, Kevin Keegan and Tony Woodcock. That's why parents, fascinated by this ambassador for English sport, paid him the supreme compliment, and the years 1977 and 78 saw the sudden entry of the name Kevin in the hit parade of popular first names on German birth certificates. Kevin. Read on.
I think I won there. I think that's the most boring, harmless line to come out of the book of Schumacher.
Will you stop? Will you stop? No, you're putting up to me now.
47.
One more page. 47. Okay, all right.
Rob goes firmly for the heart of, you know, the inciting incident section of the book.
Okay, so the point of the Schumacher experiment is that the line will prompt you to read the next line. Any line will prompt you to read the next line. Thinking and brooding about my collision with Patrick Battiston had gradually dampened my happy-go-lucky nature. Now!
There you go. Join us tomorrow, folks.
Highly tempted. I'm going to ask for page 47 tomorrow again.
Just before we go, a little request from us to you. If you're enjoying the shows, please follow, like and rate them. We'd love to see your comments and feedback. And if you'd like to support what we're doing, you can always buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Hispania82, where we've left a bonus episode for those who do. See you next time, and thanks for listening.